Well, I think at this time, before we run you all out of here, I will introduce our next speaker. I know I met this man long years ago. He don't remember it, and I don't either. It's an honest program, I mean. There's one thing that I have for sure got about this program. I'll guarantee you I will preserve your anonymity. I won't remember your name tomorrow. So without any further, I'll give you John M. from Pennsylvania.
I know one thing about this program. The gal that picked him to be the chairperson, she guaranteed me I could relax. And what's in there, I can relax. My name is John McHugh. I am an alcoholic and a member of the Monroeville Group of Pennsylvania, the very finest group in the world. You know, we say that word, I am an alcoholic. It's a very alliterative phrase. And oftentimes, you know, you find yourself saying that very easily. And new people coming into our program probably wonder if we all start off that way. But you got to be careful. If you're sober a while, you sometimes join other organizations. I joined the Sarah Club, and I was assigned one time to speak to a group on the essential and immutable aspects of the priesthood. And as I was sitting waiting for my turn, I got to thinking that, what the hell am I doing here? Down in the basement of that church, Protestant church in that town, there were my friends. And if I were down there right now, I'd be very comfortable. And I was going, my mind was just with my friends in the basement of the Protestant church when they called on me. And so I got up, and you know what I said? My name is John McHugh, and I am, and just caught myself in time. And so I added, glad to be here. And I am glad to be here. You know, the first group of AA I belonged to, we had four members. Now, each of us had to lead the meeting, and the idea of that was that we could get to know the pattern, the drinking pattern of our fellow members. Because, you know, if one of us got drunk, we lost 25% of our group. So happened one of us got drunk. Two of us went looking for him. Now, we knew where he drank, and so we went there. And I went in, went through the place, and he wasn't there, come out. By the way, the other guy had the only car in the group. And I said, well, he's not there. He said, well, really, don't expect him to be there. Down two blocks on a back street, there's a place called Junior Grill. And he said, that's where he'd be. So we went down. I went in, looked for him. He wasn't there. Came back out, and I sat in the car. And as we were deciding what we'd do next, down the street came our fourth member. And he walked into the vestibule of the Junior Grill. And just as he got to the door, I rolled the window down and called to him. And he backed up and ran down the street. I got out of the car to go after him and ran right into our other member. So we were busy with him. I was always glad I hadn't caught up with our first guy. Because, you know, about 6 months later, he was leading an AA meeting. And he said, just as I was about to enter that gin mill, God called to me. Now you know who's here. You know, I have another thing I'd like to share with you. When I came in AA, we didn't have the Serenity Prayer. We didn't have the moment of silence. We were very shortly away from the Oxford group. And so we used to call on people to pray. And they used to pray. They used to call down upon this group, you know, from the Bible, my Lord is my shepherd, we shall not want. People used to go on and on with their prayers. And so I prepared a prayer. Shame, I never got to use it. No one ever called on me to open a meeting with a prayer. I never wanted to forget it, and seriously, I wrote this prayer. And so I would like to open my part of this meeting with my prayer. Almighty God, grant us strength and faith to gain or to maintain sobriety. Cleanse our hearts from all vain, perverse, and distracting thoughts. Enlighten our minds and inflame our hearts so that we may follow the 12 steps to recovery worthily, attentively, and devoutly, so that we may deserve to be heard in the divine presence through Christ our Lord. Amen. When some members were called upon who couldn't think of a prayer, the person calling upon them would wait a reasonable length of time and then say amen. That's where your moment of silent prayer came from. Later, one after another began to repeat the Serenity Prayer. So in the area of the country in which I come from, practically every AA meeting is now open with the Serenity Prayer. I feel just a little bit not at home because I did not hear that. So if you will join with me, we are going to open my part of this meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God, you have to accept things I cannot change, to change the things of things I think. I'd like to then start off to tell you how I got into AA. On my way to the first AA meeting, I like what the girl that opened this meeting said. If you don't give your surrender date, your sobriety date, you don't have it. My sobriety date is December 27th, 1945. As you know, at that time, there were very few AAs, and the first 100 had been in by 40. And in the years 40 to 45, all you young guys were out doing a job for the service, and you weren't worrying much about coming into AA. And then when you get out in 45, you're having a hell of a good time spending your mustering out pay, and you weren't worrying much about coming in AA. So the growth of AA really began from the year 45 on. So I was going to my first AA meeting. I was on my way up a dark, miserable street. It was raining. It was a December night. I had a pair of pants on that had the patch on the knee. I had shoes on in which I had cardboard because of the holes in them. And as I walked toward a church, not of my faith, in which I had really didn't want to go, just as I turned away from going into that meeting, a man said to me, "Are you looking for a bunch of drunks?" I'm awful glad that, and never mind am I using his name, that Maury's service was in that courtyard that night. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Come, I'll show you where they are." Now, if there ever was a direct antithesis of me, it was Maury's service. He was the sales manager of one of the largest oil companies in the world, a vestryman of the Episcopal Church, and of course, he had found AA through the Oxford group. He took me up the steps of that meeting, and it should happen to everyone else going into AA. I opened the door, and I walked in, and I saw one of my best drinking buddies there. And I said, "Red, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm the chairman." He beat me in by 10 days. He was moving the chairs. He always did put me down. Now, we had dissipated college educations. We had gone all the way down to where we were working in a foundry. We had lost our automobile. We were now riding trains to work. He would get on at the station before my station. I'd get on at my station. We'd ride to work on the train. One morning, I remembered looking at him. It came back to me. The last time I had seen him, we were on our way to work in a foundry. Red Delphi was in a full dress suit, white tie and tails, on his way to work in a foundry. As I walked back through the coach, I looked at him. I said, "Red, I said, what are you doing?" He said, "They said, shrup or else I'm going to shrup." You know, he did. He took the cummerbund off. He took the white tie off. He took the tie off, wrapped a bandana around his head. He tried to grind those castings, but he wasn't coming within 6 inches of them. The other guys would take the grinder and grind the burrs off so they wouldn't get cut. So, you know, when you walk into an AA meeting and you see a guy like that there, you sort of right away think you look okay. You know, if he hadn't been there, I don't think I would have stayed, because there were four great big signs on the wall. Absolute love, absolute honesty, absolute purity and absolute unselfishness. You know, forget, you know, the bottom of that. I never believed in an absolute. The rug, it was a small meeting. The rug was very thick. The chairs were very comfortable, all overstuffed furniture. And the meeting began, and a guy came out, and he opened it up by saying you have to have an honest desire to stop drinking. Now, I didn't even have a desire to stop drinking. Nowhere, no matter about an honest, I was there because I was pressured to be there. And so it was fortunate for me that the speaker of that meeting was a medical doctor. Now, I went into that meeting with the world on my shoulders. I was forced to go there. I didn't want to be there. And do you know the thing I disliked most about the meeting? I don't think I ever heard anyone else say they did. I hated the laughter. They should be very serious. They should be ready to take care of me. They should not be laughing. Could hardly not help laughing at this doctor. He was telling about being an intern, and he was on his way to a party, and the difficulty of a bachelor who has a bow tie. Because a bachelor with a bow tie who drinks has an awful time, and he untied his tie, and he was showing how difficult it is to tie a bow tie. And then he said he went out the front door and down past the nurse's residence on his way to the party, and all the nurses on the veranda, I never forgot the word, were laughing at him. And then he found out later when he got to the party that he had forgotten to put on his pants. You know, that wasn't exactly what I went to that AA meeting to hear. But he did say something that was very helpful to me. He said he was a medical doctor and that he treated people for disease and for injury. And he said, if I treat a man for the fracture of the tip of his little finger, or if I treat a man for a compound fracture of his hip, I'm treating a fracture. And he likened that to alcoholism. And I had never heard of alcoholism being a disease. And so it somehow made sense. Now, I had written to AA, and I had gotten literature from AA in which they had described alcoholism. We have medicine books of alcoholics. There was an old pamphlet. And so after the meeting, they had all these comments. I made no comments until after the meeting, and then I wanted to argue with one and all that I was not an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, I wanted them to explain to me that there was a definition of an alcoholic in this literature they sent me, and I wanted someone to explain it to me. So they said, what was the definition? And I said, an alcoholic has a narcissistic, egocentric core, dominated by feelings of omnipotence and willing to go to any end to maintain his own inner integrity. They said that to me. None of those guys knew what the hell it meant. No one knew what it meant. So you know what they said to me? What the hell are you doing here? This is where alcoholics come. If you don't know you're an alcoholic, the place for you to find out you're an alcoholic is where they serve booze. Now you go, and you try that, and if you have enough, God willing, you come back. Because we don't believe guys your age will make the necessary surrender necessary to accept our program. Well, you know, that's great. That was really good for me. Everybody was rejecting me. Had they offered my open arms, I wouldn't know how to react. But when they too told me to get out, the hell with them. Then they said to me, by the way, you're at this meeting, you live in the next little place, there's another meeting, four guys. They call themselves the Four Horsemen because they ride roughshod over everyone. They don't like meeting in churches, so they meet in a dance hall. But I just got to go on this. If you ever want an experience, you go to an AA meeting in a dance hall in which all one side are mirrors where the little girls get up there and practice, and you face that. Now, I was not a shaker. I never shook. I jumped. Did you ever drink with a guy that jumped? Did you ever drink with a guy that jumped? He was dangerous. He spilled your drinks. Now, I was sitting in that AA meeting and looking in that mirror. It was really something to see. Next day, I went to the meeting. There was one other man at that first meeting. He was my old mailman. He was a member of the Canned Heat Gang of our area. And I hadn't seen him for a long time. I had no idea he was sober. And he was there. And he walked home with me. You know, car checks, streetcar rides in Pittsburgh when I came in, You got three card checks for a quarter. I had no card checks. I walked to AA meetings. By the way, I never walked home from one. I never could figure that out. Somebody always managed to take me home on a streetcar. But I walked to that meeting. The next night he showed up in my house, and he, of course, I was in bed. You know how tired you get when you start getting sober? Very tired. Got to go to bed. Got to rest. He showed up, and of course, I wouldn't get up. He suggested that someone come back and say, get rid of my sober, drunken friends. I don't want to put up with that. And so they came back and got me up. I tried to talk to him, gave him a lot of business, and he left with me, walked me to a meeting. At this meeting, the same thing happened. These people were, there were only a few people there. They were not about to try to convince me. And the reason that they told me, I kept coming back. They didn't tell me to. I just showed them. I kept coming back. After I had been there about 6 months, they asked me one night, McHugh, are you ready to resign from the debating society? And I said, yes. They said, good, let's go in the back room and talk. We can do the dishes. In those days, they actually had dishes. By the way, they also made coffee. We didn't have electric coffee pots. We used to take cheesecloth and sew them into a bag and put coffee in there and get a big pot with hot water and throw the thing in and stir it. Stir it. Now, you could always tell the weakest member of the group. They were given the cheesecloth bags to take home and launder. That guarantees they're coming back the next week. Sometimes they come back and throw, here's your damn bags, and leave, but we got our bags back every week. So they told me about, first of all, they said to me, where did you ever get the idea that you have to admit you're an alcoholic to be in AA? I said, everybody wants me to admit I'm an alcoholic. They said, we understand English very well. Where in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous does it say anything about you're admitting you're an alcoholic? What's the first step, John? And when I told them, of course, that we were powerless. They said, well, do me a favor. You go home, and you look in the mirror, and you ask yourself a question, who's boss, me or booze? A very simple question. They said, we don't even know what an alcoholic is. You know, except for the medical people in this room, I would defy any of you to give me a definition of an alcoholic. Just think for a minute, if you respond mentally to that thing, what you're talking about is a description. You're describing an alcoholic. You're not defining it. So they told me to go home and take a look in that mirror and ask that, myself that question. I had no trouble with that. I just thought, you know, later on, we did what we were told to do by our sponsor. In those days, they said, when you get a sponsor, you ask them two questions. First, you ask that person you're considering to be your sponsor, do you have a sponsor? Now, if that person doesn't have a sponsor, they can't respond to you as your sponsor. So then you go on and look for someone else. And if they answer yes to the question, they have a sponsor, you ask them what step they're working. And if they tell you all of them, you run like hell. And if they don't know what step they're working, they're not working any steps, so you go get another person to be your sponsor. So they told me to go home and ask this question to myself. Some years later, you know, we did what we were told to do. I had a pigeon, and I got a telephone call on a real hot, humid night like last night. And he said to me, John, I was about to go to bed. He said, I said to my beloved Sarah Elizabeth, I don't know whether I should go to bed with the top of my pajamas on, the bottom of my pajamas on, or in the buff. And he said, she looked at me and snarled, why the hell don't you ask your AA sponsor? You ask him everything else. When I looked in that mirror, I knew why I was there. I had remembered that I was in a jail cell, that I had awakened in that jail cell, and I had a pair of dungarees on, and I had shoes without laces. It had been taken away from me because I was listed as a suicide. I had tried to commit suicide in that same jail cell because after a prolonged attempt to not drink, I had drank. And so that I knew exactly who was boss. And so I came back. And then I told them that I knew booze was boss. And they told me about the book. I brought my book, by the way, which is in my possession at the moment. This is the 12th big book. When we talk about the big book in AA, we often think that refers to the fact that this is like the Bible. The first big books were big books. Look at it. You know? This book was the 12th one off the shelf. It was given to the Cambridge, Ohio, the only newspaper, daily newspaper in Jefferson County. And it was given because they hoped that he would give them some publicity on this new edition of this book. Frank Amos later gave this book to his doctor to keep in AA. The doctor later gave his book to Mike Mulligan, who was a friend of mine. I was given the book at Mike Mulligan's death to keep and pass it along to another good AA, so that this book would always remain in the presence of AA, good AA members who would take it and share it. They told me about this book. They told me that when they got this book ready, there was 179 pages. And that was all. And when they took it to the printer, they said, print it on big paper, heavy paper, use big type. We wanted to sell a lot of these books. And tentatively, it was called This Way Out. When they got to New York and Washington and checked, there had already been 12 This Way Outs. They didn't want to be the 13th This Way Out if they were going to sell a lot of books. So they went back to reconsider it. This was 5 years. In our area, the people who were going to meetings for alcoholism were attending meetings of the alcoholic squad of the Oxford group. Finally, it was decided to call this book Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1939, our group, no, won't get into that, but we now have our name Alcoholics Anonymous. They said to me, John, do you understand that had they considered this, and you don't want to call yourself an alcoholic, that had they called this book Dipsomaniac Delivered, you'd have to call yourself John, I'm a dipsomaniac. Or Lushes Liberated, you know, there could have been a lot of things. So they explained to me that this book was the foundation. And they incidentally, too, they explained to me that in this book they referred to our stories. There were no meetings of AA in 39 when this book was written, except the meetings of this alcoholic squad. So they were referring to the stories in the back of the book, which they had added to this and called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me that what I had to do was to give them 6 months on that first step. And then I heard my first heresy. They told me if I gave them 6 months on the first step, that I never again in my life would have to admit I was an alcoholic. Now that really sounded heresy. That was 34 and a half years ago, and you know what? They were right. Because if you give me 6 months on that first step, you'll come to accept. And when you come to accept that, then you never again have to admit it till you take a drink. And that was what they were trying to get across to me. Then they told me another heresy. They told me that I would never have trouble with any step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That if I was uncomfortable trying to work any step in this program, it meant only one thing. I simply hadn't finished the step before it. If I admit I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life is unmanageable, I'm stuck unless I come to believe that something, if I'm completely powerless, that something can do it. And they also told me that I could never learn how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Because no one can do that. No theologian knows how to turn his will and his life over the care of God. No one does. And the program doesn't call for us to do it. Just think of that. How many times have you heard an AA speaker tell about the troubles they have trying to turn their will and their life over the care of God? It doesn't say that. It says simply that we make the decision and then he takes over. And we can make that decision. You know, I always like to quote to people the Bible when I was drinking. That Jesus' first public miracle, remembering the boys in the back room, they were going to be out of booze. Poor fellas, got to do something about it. You know, he didn't send for Drake and some pretty girls to jump on him. Didn't do that. He says, put some water in the jug. And then he pours it out, and it's the finest wine. That's what we have to do with that third step. We make the decision to turn it over to him, and he takes it over. They pointed out to me that my life, if I would just live it in conjunction with this AA program, would be a very simple life. It's something that I could work and be happy. And I'm happy that they did it. So really then, there should have been three A's in AA. Somehow we should have got a third A. Should have been admittance, acceptance, and action. And somewhere along the line, we should be told by our sponsors that action is not activity. Activity in AA is easy. 7.5 meetings, 25 meetings a week. You know, they told me if I was out in that Mississippi River in the middle of it, that there's a program in AA. And if I was out there drowning, and calling for help, I wouldn't be looking for the guy that could tell the best AA story, or the guy that is the nicest guy I know, or the prettiest gal to come out to the middle of that Mississippi River. Because if they made it out there, we'd both drown. What we should hope, if we're out in the middle of the Mississippi River, and we're having difficulty, and we call for help, is someone who comes out that knows how to swim. Knows how to swim, because that's what we need. They told me that we could find in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous the nicest people in the world in this program. That's different. In our fellowship, there are people who stay in AA and stay sober, thank God, without a program. So if you really want to turn and look for help, John, you find a sponsor, follow our direction, and begin a program. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is a program. This program has been good to me. It's taught me that I have to. You know, it's taught me the hard way, though. 5 years after I was sober, I was sitting on my front steps broke on a holiday. 5 years after I'm sober, I'm broke. I'm doing no good at all, right? You know, I never was broke on a holiday when I drank. Now, I know now that that was because the day before the holiday, I went to the personal finance, household finance, and I ran between them and I got the money. I always had money in my pocket. So I decided to get drunk. Next door to me lived a policeman. My friend George T. here has trouble with this after all these years. I hate cops. I have worked on that, and you know why God gives dogs fleas? To remind them they're dogs. God gives me this hatred for being put in jail so many times to remind me I'm an alcoholic. I'm never gonna forget it as long as I have that feeling. So I used to take him to AA meetings. Took him to a lot of AA meetings, try to change his attitude towards alcoholics. I went next door to him and said, I'm going to get drunk. Let's go to the state store. He says, okay. And then he's a big guy, so he's edging me, and he's taking me the long way around. He told me later the only thing he learned in AA was the urge to drink, if delayed, will pass. So he was going to give me a delay. He was taking me a long way around. When I finally got to the liquor store, I bought a fifth of my favorite drink, Chenley Black Label, Chenley Reserve. And then we came down the street, and I was limited to the places I could go in to buy six beers. But I finally went into got six beers. And then I remember my children, and I bought each of them a 7-Up. Now, I walked in my living room, and of course, this was a long time before TV, so everybody is sitting around reading, listening to the radio. I got a bag of beer under this arm, a bag at the state store under this arm. Nobody had any trouble recognizing those things. You could carry them like this, and everybody know what you have. I went out, and I poured a drink. Four fingers for me, reasonable drink for Bill, opened us up each a beer. A lot of the kids then opened them up to 7-Up. And you know, just as I picked up that drink to drink it, standing in the doorway was my little 11-year-old daughter with the tears just streaming down her cheeks. So Almighty God sent a child's tears as a deterrent. And I put down that drink, and I called, and it was taken from me, and I picked up a 7-Up. You know, nobody could come closer to taking a drink than that. So that when Bob said here how we feel about those who have taken the drink, that we who are so fortunate that since we've come in the program have never needed to drink, that the ones who took the drink we thought of drinking, we're most grateful for. Because it takes more guts to come through that door the second, fifth, 15th, or 500th time than it does to come through once. who have taken the drink, that we who are so fortunate that since we've come in the program have never needed to drink, that the ones who took the drink we thought of drinking, we're most grateful for. Because it takes more guts to come through that door the second, fifth, 15th, or 500th time than it does to come through once. I searched for the reason why I took that drink, why I was that close. One night I went to a meeting, there was a Marine sergeant there. I was going to meeting after meeting after meeting because I was afraid. And at that meeting, this sergeant looked out and he said, "Did you ask for help today? How about you? How about you? I know you asked when you were first sober, but how about today? Did you really honestly ask for God's help today to go through this day?" And you know, I hadn't. I had started acting like normal people. I no longer felt the need to ask every day, I guess. So I can honestly tell you that from that day to this, which are many thousands of days, I have known that I ask because I write it down. I write it down. I have a deal with myself, too. If I find myself having not asked, no matter where I am, I get down on my knees to that point. Now, sometimes I pretend to be high in my shoes, but I get down on my knees at that point and I ask for help just because I never again want that to happen. We have some parkways in Pittsburgh, I'm sure. They're called parkways because we spend more time sitting on them than we do driving them. You have throughways. We don't have those. But once I got on that damn parkway and I remembered I parked the car and got out and went back in and hooked it to the back tire, knelt down. I've never entered the parkway without thinking of that and never have. I don't want to ever do that again. But I say to you that these are the kind of things. Now, the early AAs wanted to be of help. They were of help. The very fact that they made us work for it was good, and I'm grateful for that. I have to share one other thing with you, which strikes me as being a coincidence. Bob is in Los Angeles, and I'm in Pittsburgh, and we share a mutual pigeon. Seeing him here tonight was really a surprise to me. A man who moved from Pittsburgh area ended up as his pigeon in, what do you call them, babies? We call them pigeons. You know why, don't you? You know why people call pigeons? You know what that comes out from them sounds like cuckoo, cuckoo. And you all know what pigeons do. You call them babies out of it. But just strange that in a meeting like this, of all the people that the two of us, and also my friend here who came to the area of Pennsylvania to talk, I want to share with you that one of the things that I have done to stay sober is that I'm a peddler. Every day I go to work, I have lunch with someone, and I have a drink. He usually has a drink. My company never has allowed me to ask anyone to have a drink. That's incidental. They figure if the guy's important enough for me to take the lunch, I'll take him where there's a cocktail waitress, not into a saloon, okay? So she asks him. I never do, so that I never have any trouble saying no, okay? So what I've done a long time ago was that sometimes those drinks look good. Sometimes when I look at that drink, it looks good. And so what I've done is I made up my drink. I would like to suggest to you that I'll share it with you. Do you remember when you were actively drinking? If anyone told you they had a recipe for a drink, you sort of listened. It gave you an opportunity maybe to get near the source of supply. Put a little fat, have a fat in. So I'd like to suggest to you that while I'm telling you how I construct my drink, could you think for a moment about what brings you here today and brings you to so many AA meetings and make up your own drink? My drink comes from 100 proof booze. The bottle I reach for is 100 proof because in that bottle there is terror, bewilderment, frustration, unreasonable fears, resentments, anxiety, care, worry, suspicion. And when that guy picks up that bottle and he pours out a jigger of that, he's going to pour it into a glass in which I'm going to stir in the heartache of my wife and my family. I'm going to mix in there the creditors, the dunnings of my creditors. I'm going to add the bitters of the horrible experience of going through the fourth and fifth steps. And then I'm going to dilute that. It would be too tough to take by the crocodile tears I'm going to shed when I say, why did I do it? And I'm going to drink that drink. And I'm going to put back into me all those things that have taken me so long to do such a lousy job of removing. I respectfully submit to you that you take the ingredients that have brought you to the realization that you belong here, that you construct yourself a drink, so that the next time that you think, the hell with it, it ain't worth it, the next time that you reach and look for something that looks like it should be okay, the next time you think, maybe I look like, feel like, act like, and say I am an alcoholic, but down deep inside I really am not, that you will remember your drink, and whatever you're tempted to take will be the one you construct. Thank you.
Thank you, John. This could go as one of the first old-time meetings that ever closed on time. But I'm sorry the other fellow didn't show up. Sorry I had to talk so much. No, I'm not. I'm proud of it. I want to thank you, John, very much. You, Bob. This has been a great experience for me. And I just might explain some of the words he said. You don't realize. I heard Dr. Bob say, keep it simple in his last talk, and keep it any simpler than I am, you might not get it at all. But I too heard a doctor explain this, and I accepted it the way he told it. He said, give it an alcoholic a pint of alcohol, and a non-alcoholic a pint of alcohol, and tap the spine in 12 hours. The alcoholic retained it in his system. The non-alcoholic threw some filter through it off. He talked like this for about an hour. He was real brilliant. He used a lot of the words you heard. I didn't understand him, doubted if he did, but when he got through, I came to the brilliant conclusion that I had busted my strainer and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. All due respect to the medical profession that has helped us so much, they get kidded a lot, but they too sometimes get frustrated. I was recently in a hospital. A few days, they wanted to take pictures to see what it was, I guess. Anyway, the doctor come down the hall, and the nurse grabbed him and said, wait a minute, Doc, why are you so frustrated this morning? He says, go away, I'm not frustrated. She said, well, what are you doing with that rectal thermometer behind your ear? And he grabbed it out and says, oh my God, wonder where my pencil is. But if I get sick, I want me a doctor. I'll tell you that. I don't know how much they know about alcoholism. We got some fine doctors back in the woods where I come from. One of them treated a fellow for yellow jaundice back there for about a year before he found out he was a Chinaman. But I usually close all of my programs by an old story that I have told many times, and this is true in my case. I do appreciate your old timer staying and listening to me, and I'm sorry the other speaker didn't show up, but I most always close the meeting by telling you the story of the man with the one-string fiddle. I've told it all over the country, but to me the program has been so great, I can't explain it any better than to tell you about the old man back in the mountain that bought a fiddle, and he had one string, and he played it.
just seesaw, seesaw, until his wife about to go nuts. She says, I don't understand it. Said, most people run the hand up and down the neck of that thing. He says, I know they do, but said, I found what I want. Thank you very much.